The barrack we had been assigned to was very long. On the roof, a few bluish skylights. I thought, this is what the antechamber of hell must look like. So many crazed men. So much shouting, so much brutality. Dozens of inmates were there to receive us, sticks in hand, striking anywhere, anyone, without reason. The orders came, strip, hurry up, raus, hold on only to your belt and your shoes. Our clothes were to be thrown on the floor at the back of the barrack. There was a pile there already, new suits, old ones, torn overcoats, rags. For us it meant true equality, nakedness. We trembled in the cold. A few SS officers wandered through the room looking for strong men. If vigor was that appreciated, perhaps one should try to appear sturdy. My father thought the opposite, better not to draw attention. We later found out that he had been right. Those who were selected that day were incorporated into the Sonderkommando, the commando working in the crematoria. Bela Katz, the son of an important merchant of my town, had arrived in Birkenau with the first transport 1 week ahead of us. When he found out that we were there, he succeeded in slipping us a note. He told us that having been chosen because of his strength, he had been forced to place his own father's body into the furnace. The blows continued to rain on us. To the barber! Belt and shoes in hand, I let myself be dragged along to the barber's. Their clippers tore out our hair, shaved every hair on our bodies. My head was buzzing, the same thought surfacing over and over, not to be separated from my father. Freed from the barber's clutches, we began to wander about the crowd, finding friends, acquaintances. Every encounter filled us with joy. Yes, joy. Thank God you are still alive. Some were crying. They used whatever strength they had left to cry. Why had they let themselves be brought here? Why didn't they die in their beds? Their words were interspersed with sobs. Suddenly, someone threw his arms around me in a hug. Yechiel, the Zigeter Rebbe's brother. He was weeping bitterly. I thought he was crying with joy at still being alive. "Don't cry, Yechiel," I said. "Don't waste your tears." "Not cry. We're on the threshold of death. Soon we shall be inside. Do you understand? Inside. How could I not cry?" I watched darkness fade through the bluish skylights in the roof. I no longer was afraid. I was overcome by fatigue. The absent no longer entered our thoughts. One spoke of them. Who knows what happened to them? But their fate was not on our minds. We were incapable of thinking. Our senses were numbed. Everything was fading into a fog. We no longer clung to anything. The instincts of self-preservation, of self-defense, of pride, had all deserted us. In one terrifying moment of lucidity, I thought of us as damned souls wandering through the void, souls condemned to wander through space until the end of time, seeking redemption, seeking oblivion, without any hope of finding either. Around 5 o'clock in the morning, we were expelled from the barrack. The capos were beating us again, but I no longer felt the pain. A glacial wind was enveloping us. We were naked, holding our shoes and belts. An order, run! And we ran. After a few minutes of running, a new barrack. A barrel of foul-smelling liquid stood by the door. Disinfection. Everybody soaked in it. Then came a hot shower, all very fast. As we left the showers, we were chased outside and ordered to run some more. Another barrack, the storeroom. Very long tables, mountains of prison garb. As we ran, they threw the clothes at us, pants, jackets, shirts. In a few seconds we had ceased to be men. Had the situation not been so tragic, we might have laughed. We looked pretty strange. Mayor Katz, a colossus, wore a child's pants, and Stern, a skinny little fellow, was floundering in a huge jacket. We immediately started to switch. I glanced over at my father. How changed he looked. His eyes were veiled. I wanted to tell him something, but I didn't know what. The night had passed completely. The morning star shone in the sky. I, too, had become a different person. The student of Talmud, the child I was, had been consumed by the flames. All that was left was a shape that resembled me. My soul had been invaded and devoured by a black flame. So many events had taken place in just a few hours that I had completely lost all notion of time. When had we left our homes and the ghetto and the train? Only a week ago? One night? One single night? How long had we been standing in the freezing wind? 1 hour? A single hour? 60 minutes? Surely it was a dream. Not far from us, prisoners were at work. Some were digging holes, others were carrying sand. None as much as glanced at us. We were withered trees in the heart of the desert. Behind me, people were talking. I had no desire to listen to what they were saying, or to know who was speaking and what about. Nobody dared raise his voice. Even though there was no guard around, we whispered. Perhaps because of the thick smoke that poisoned the air and stung the throat. We were herded into yet another barrack inside the gypsy camp. We fell into ranks of five. "And now stop moving!" There was no floor. A roof and four walls. Our feet sank into the mud. Again the waiting. I fell asleep standing up. I dreamed of a bed, of my mother's hand on my face. I woke. I was standing, my feet in the mud. Some people collapsed, sliding into the mud. Others shouted, "Are you crazy? We were told to stand. Do you want to get us all in trouble?" As if all the troubles in the world were not already upon us. Little by little, we all sat down in the mud. But we had to get up whenever a capo came in to check if, by chance, somebody had a new pair of shoes. If so, we had to hand them over. No use protesting. The blows multiplied, and in the end, one still had to hand them over. I had new shoes myself, but as they were covered with a thick coat of mud, they had not been noticed. I thanked God, in an improvised prayer, for having created mud in his infinite and wondrous universe. Suddenly the silence became more oppressive. An SS officer had come in, and with him, the smell of the angel of death. We stared at his fleshy lips. He harangued us from the center of the barrack. "You are in a concentration camp, in Auschwitz." A pause. He was observing the effect his words had produced. His face remains in my memory to this day. A tall man, in his 30s. Crime written all over his forehead and his gaze. He looked at us as one would a pack of leprous dogs clinging to life. "Remember," he went on, "remember it always. Let it be graven in your memories. You are in Auschwitz, and Auschwitz is not a convalescent home. It is a concentration camp. Here you must work. If you don't, you will go straight to the chimney, to the crematorium. Work or crematorium. The choice is yours." We had already lived through a lot that night. We thought that nothing could frighten us any more. But his harsh words sent shivers through us. The word chimney here was not an abstraction. It floated in the air, mingled with the smoke. It was perhaps the only word that had a real meaning in this place. He left the barrack. The capos arrived, shouting, "All specialists, locksmiths, carpenters, electricians, watchmakers, one step forward." The rest of us were transferred to yet another barrack, this one of stone. We had permission to sit down. A gypsy inmate was in charge. My father suddenly had a colic attack. He got up and asked politely in German, "Excuse me, could you tell me where the toilets are located?" The gypsy stared at him for a long time from head to toe, as if he wished to ascertain that the person addressing him was actually a creature of flesh and bone, a human being with a body and a belly. Then, as if waking from a deep sleep, he slapped my father with such force that he fell down and then crawled back to his place on all fours. I stood petrified. what had happened to me. My father had just been struck in front of me, and I had not even blinked. I had watched and kept silent. Only yesterday I would have dug my nails into this criminal's flesh. Had I changed that much so fast? Remorse began to gnaw at me. All I could think was, I shall never forgive them for this. My father must have guessed my thoughts because he whispered in my ear, "It doesn't hurt." His cheek still bore the red mark of the hand. "Everybody outside!" A dozen or so gypsies had come to join our guard. The clubs and whips were cracking around me. My feet were running on their own. I tried to protect myself from the blows by hiding behind others. It was spring. The sun was shining. "Fall in, 5 by 5. The prisoners I had glimpsed that morning were working nearby. No guard in sight, only the chimney's shadow. Lulled by the sunshine and my dreams, I felt someone pulling at my sleeve. It was my father. "Come on, son." We marched. Gates opened and closed. We continued to march between the barbed wire. At every step, white signs with black skulls looked down on us. The inscription, "Warning, danger of death." What irony. Was there here a single place where one was not in danger of death? The gypsies had stopped next to a barrack. They were replaced by SS men who encircled us with machine guns and police dogs. The march had lasted half an hour. Looking around me, I noticed that the barbed wire was behind us. We had left the camp. It was a beautiful day in May. The fragrances of spring were in the air. The sun was setting. But no sooner had we taken a few more steps than we saw the barbed wire of another camp. This one had an iron gate with the overhead inscription, "Arbeit macht frei." Work makes you free. Auschwitz. First impression. Better than Birkenau. Cement buildings with two stories rather than wooden barracks. Little gardens here and there. We were led toward one of those blocks. Seated on the ground by the entrance, we began to wait again. From time to time, somebody was allowed to go in. These were the showers, a compulsory routine. Going from one camp to the other several times a day, we had each time to go through them. After the hot shower, we stood shivering in the darkness. Our clothes had been left behind. We had been promised other clothes. Around midnight, we were told to run. "Faster," yelled our guards. "The faster you run, the faster you'll get to go to sleep." After a few minutes of racing madly, we came to a new block. The man in charge was waiting. He was a young Pole who was smiling at us. He began to talk to us, and despite our weariness, we listened attentively. "Comrades, you are now in the concentration camp Auschwitz. Ahead of you lies a long road paved with suffering. Don't lose hope. You have already eluded the worst danger, the selection. Therefore, muster your strength and keep your faith. We shall all see the day of liberation. Have faith in life, 1,000 times faith. By driving out despair, you will move away from death. Hell does not last forever. And now, here is a prayer, or rather, a piece of advice. Let there be camaraderie among you. We are all brothers and share the same fate. The same smoke hovers over all our heads. Help each other. That is the only way to survive. And now, enough said, you are tired. Listen, you are in Block 17. I am responsible for keeping order here. Anyone with a complaint may come to see me. That is all. Go to sleep. 2 people to a bunk. Good night." Those were the first human words. No sooner had we climbed into our bunks than we fell into a deep sleep. The next morning, the veteran inmates treated us without brutality. We went to wash. We were given new clothing. They brought us black coffee. We left the block around 10 o'clock so it could be cleaned. Outside, the sun warmed us. Our morale was much improved. A good night's sleep had done its work. Friends met, exchanged a few sentences. We spoke of everything without ever mentioning those who had disappeared. The prevailing opinion was that the war was about to end. At about noon, we were brought some soup, one bowl of thick soup for each of us. I was terribly hungry, yet I refused to touch it. I was still the spoiled child of long ago. My father swallowed my ration. We then had a short nap in the shade of the block. That SS officer in the muddy barrack must have been lying. Auschwitz was, after all, a convalescent home. In the afternoon, they made us line up. Three prisoners brought a table and some medical instruments. We were told to roll up our left sleeves and file past the table. The three veteran prisoners, needles in hand, tattooed numbers on our left arms. I became A7713. From then on, I had no other name. At dusk, a roll call. The work commandos had returned. The orchestra played military marches near the camp entrance. Tens of thousands of inmates stood in rows while the SS checked their numbers. After the roll call, the prisoners from all the blocks dispersed, looking for friends, relatives, or neighbors among the arrivals of the latest convoy. Days went by. In the mornings, black coffee. At midday, soup. By the third day, I was eagerly eating any kind of soup. At 6 o'clock in the afternoon, roll call, followed by bread with something. At 9 o'clock, bedtime. We had already been in Auschwitz for 8 days. It was after roll call we stood waiting for the bell announcing its end. Suddenly, I noticed someone passing between the rows. I heard him ask, "Who among you is Wiesel von Siegert?" The person looking for us was a small fellow with spectacles and a wizened face. My father answered, "That's me, Wiesel von Siegert." The fellow's eyes narrowed. He took a long look at my father. "You don't know me? You don't recognize me? I'm your relative, Stein. Already forgotten? Stein. Stein from Antwerp. Riesel's husband. Your wife was Riesel's aunt. She often wrote to us, and such letters." My father had not recognized him. He must have barely known him, always being up to his neck in communal affairs and not knowledgeable in family matters. He was always elsewhere, lost in thought. Once, a cousin came to see us in Siegert. She had stayed at our house and eaten at our table for 2 weeks before my father noticed her presence for the first time. No, he did not remember Stein. I recognized him right away. I had known Riesel, his wife, before she had left for Belgium. He told us that he had been deported in 1942. He said, "I heard people say that a transport had arrived from your region, and I came to look for you. I thought you might have some news of Riesel and my two small boys who stayed in Antwerp." I knew nothing about them. Since 1940, my mother had not received a single letter from them. But I lied. Yes, my mother did hear from them. Riesel is fine, so are the children. He was weeping with joy. He would have liked to stay longer to learn more details, to soak up the good news, but an SS was heading in our direction, and he had to go, telling us that he would come back the next day. The bell announced that we were dismissed. We went to fetch the evening meal, bread and margarine. I was terribly hungry and swallowed my ration on the spot. My father told me, "You mustn't eat all at once. Tomorrow is another day." But seeing that his advice had come too late, and that there was nothing left of my ration, he didn't even start his own. "Me, I'm not hungry," he said. We remained in Auschwitz for 3 weeks. We had nothing to do. We slept a lot, in the afternoon and at night. Our one goal was to avoid the transports, to stay here as long as possible. It wasn't difficult. It was enough never to sign up as a skilled worker. The unskilled were kept until the end. At the start of the third week, our Blockälteste was removed. He was judged too humane. The new one was ferocious, and his aides were veritable monsters. The good days were over. We began to wonder whether it wouldn't be better to let ourselves be chosen for the next transport. Stein, our relative from Antwerp, continued to visit us, and from time to time he would bring a half portion of bread. "Here, this is for you, Eliezer." Every time he came, tears would roll down his icy cheeks. He would often say to my father, "Take care of your son. He is very weak, very dehydrated. Take care of yourselves. You must avoid selection. Eat anything, any time. Eat all you can. The weak don't last very long around here." And he himself was so thin, so withered, so weak. "The only thing that keeps me alive," he kept saying, "is to know that Rezel and the little ones are still alive. Were it not for them, I would give up." One evening he came to see us, his face radiant. "The transport just arrived from Antwerp. I shall go to see them tomorrow. Surely they will have news." He left. We never saw him again. He had been given the news. The real news. Evenings, as we lay on our cots, we sometimes tried to sing a few Hasidic melodies. Akiba Drummer would break our hearts with his deep, grave voice. Some of the men spoke of God, his mysterious ways, the sins of the Jewish people, and the redemption to come. As for me, I had ceased to pray. I concurred with Job. I was not denying his existence, but I doubted his absolute justice. Akiba Drummer said, "God is testing us. He wants to see whether we are capable of overcoming our base instincts, of killing the Satan within ourselves. We have no right to despair. And if he punishes us mercilessly, it is a sign that he loves us that much more." Hirsch Ginud, well-versed in Kabbalah, spoke of the end of the world and the coming of the Messiah. From time to time, in the middle of all that talk, a thought crossed my mind. "Where is Mother right now?" "And Zipporah?" "Mother is still a young woman," my father once said. "She must be in a labor camp." "And Zipporah, she's a big girl now. She too must be in a camp." How we would have liked to believe that. We pretended. For what if one of us still did believe? All the skilled workers had already been sent to other camps. Only about 100 of us simple laborers were left. "Today it's your turn," announced the block secretary. "You are leaving with the next transport." At 10 o'clock we were handed our daily ration of bread. A dozen or so SS surrounded us. At the gate, the sign proclaimed that work meant freedom. We were counted, and there we were, in the countryside, on a sunny road. In the sky, a few small white clouds. We were walking slowly. The guards were in no hurry. We were glad of it. As we were passing through some of the villages, many Germans watched us, showing no surprise. No doubt they had seen quite a few of these processions. On the way, we saw some young German girls. The guards began to tease them. The girls giggled. They allowed themselves to be kissed and tickled, bursting with laughter. They all were laughing, joking, and passing love notes to one another. At least, during all that time, we endured neither shouting nor blows. After 4 hours, we arrived at the new camp, Buna. The iron gate closed behind us. The camp looked as though it had been through an epidemic, empty and dead. Only a few well-dressed inmates were wandering between the blocks. Of course, we first had to pass through the showers. The head of the camp joined us there. He was a stocky man with big shoulders, the neck of a bull, thick lips and curly hair. He gave an impression of kindness. From time to time, a smile would linger in his gray-blue eyes. Our convoy included a few 10- and 12-year-olds. The officer took an interest in them and gave orders to bring them food. We were given new clothing and settled in 2 tents. We were to wait there until we could be incorporated into work commandos. Then we would be assigned to a block. In the evening, the commandos returned from the workyards. Roll call, we began looking for people we knew, asking the veterans which work commandos were the best and which block won't you try to enter. All the inmates agreed, Buna is a very good camp. One can hold one's own here. The most important thing is not to be assigned to the construction commando. As if we had a choice. Our tent leader was a German. An assassin's face, fleshy lips, hands resembling a wolf's paws. The camp's food had agreed with him. He could hardly move. He was so fat. Like the head of the camp, he liked children. Immediately after our arrival, he had bread brought for them, some soup and margarine. In fact, this affection was not entirely altruistic. There existed here a veritable traffic of children among homosexuals, I learned later. He told us, You will stay with me for 3 days in quarantine. Afterward, you will go to work. Tomorrow, medical checkup. One of his aides, a tough-looking boy with shifty eyes, came over to me. Would you like to get into a good commando? Of course, but on one condition. I want to stay with my father. All right, he said. I can arrange it. For a pittance, your shoes. I'll give you another pair. I refused to give him my shoes. They were all I had left. I'll also give you a ration of bread with some margarine. He liked my shoes. I would not let him have them. Later they were taken from me anyway, in exchange for nothing that time. The medical checkup took place outside, early in the morning, before three doctors seated on a bench. The first hardly examined me. He just asked, Are you in good health? Who would have dared to admit the opposite? On the other hand, the dentist seemed more conscientious. He asked me to open my mouth wide. In fact, he was not looking for decay, but for gold teeth. Those who had gold in their mouths were listed by their number. I did have a gold crown. The first 3 days went by quickly. On the fourth day, as we stood in front of our tent, the capos appeared. Each one began to choose the men he liked. You, you, you. They pointed their fingers the way one might choose cattle or merchandise. We followed our capo, a young man. He made us halt at the door of the first block near the entrance to the camp. This was the orchestra's block. He motioned us inside. We were surprised. What had we to do with music? The orchestra was playing a military march, always the same. Dozens of commandos were marching off in step to the workyards. The capos were beating the time. Left, right, left, right. SS officers, pen in hand, recorded the number of men leaving. The orchestra continued to play the same march until the last commando had passed. Then the conductor's baton stopped moving and the orchestra fell silent. The capo yelled, Fall in! We fell into ranks of five with the musicians. We left the camp without music but in step. We still had the march in our ears. Left, right, left, right. We struck up conversations with our neighbors, the musicians. Almost all of them were Jews. Juliek, a Pole with eyeglasses and a cynical smile in a pale face. Louis, a native of Holland, a well-known violinist. He complained that they would not let him play Beethoven. Jews were not allowed to play German music. Hans, the young man from Berlin, was full of wit. The foreman was a Pole, Franjek, a former student in Warsaw. Juliek explained to me, We work in a warehouse of electrical materials not far from here. The work is neither difficult nor dangerous. Only Idek, the capo, occasionally has fits of madness, and then you'd better stay out of his way. You are lucky, little fellow, said Hans, smiling. You fell into a good commando. 10 minutes later, we stood in front of the warehouse. A German employee, a civilian, the Meister, came to meet us. He paid as much attention to us as would a shopkeeper receiving a delivery of old rags. Our comrades were right. The work was not difficult. Sitting on the ground, we counted bolts, bulbs, and various small electrical parts. The capo launched into a lengthy explanation of the importance of this work, warning us that anyone who proved to be lazy would be held accountable. My new comrades reassured me, "Don't worry, he has to say this because of the Meister." There were many Polish civilians here, and a few French women as well. The women silently greeted the musicians with their eyes. Franek, the foreman, assigned me to a corner. "Don't kill yourself. There's no hurry. But watch out. Don't let an SS catch you." "Please, sir, I'd like to be near my father." "All right, your father will work here next to you." We were lucky. Two boys came to join our group, Jossi and Tibi, two brothers from Czechoslovakia whose parents had been exterminated in Birkenau. They lived for each other, body and soul. They quickly became my friends. Having once belonged to a Zionist youth organization, they knew countless Hebrew songs, and so we would sometimes hum melodies evoking the gentle waters of the Jordan River and the majestic sanctity of Jerusalem. We also spoke often about Palestine. Their parents, like mine, had not had the courage to sell everything and emigrate while there was still time. We decided that if we were allowed to live until the liberation, we would not stay another day in Europe. We would board the first ship to Haifa. Still lost in his Kabbalistic dreams, Akiba Drummer had discovered a verse from the Bible which, translated into numbers, made it possible for him to predict redemption in the weeks to come. We had left the tents for the musicians' block. We now were entitled to a blanket, a washbowl, and a bar of soap. The Blockälteste was a German Jew. It was good to have a Jew as your leader. His name was Alphonse, a young man with a startlingly wizened face. He was totally devoted to defending his block. Whenever he could, he would organize a cauldron of soup for the young, for the weak, for all those who dreamed more of an extra portion of food than of liberty. One day, when we had just returned from the warehouse, I was summoned by the block secretary. "A7713? "That's me." "After your meal, you'll go to see the dentist." "But I don't have a toothache." "After your meal, without fail." I went to the infirmary block. Some 20 prisoners were waiting in line at the entrance. It didn't take long to learn the reason for our summons. Our gold teeth were to be extracted. The dentist, a Jew from Czechoslovakia, had a face not unlike a death mask. When he opened his mouth, one had a ghastly vision of yellow, rotten teeth. Seated in the chair, I asked meekly, "What are you going to do, sir?" "I shall remove your gold crown, that's all," he said, clearly indifferent. I thought of pretending to be sick. "Couldn't you wait a few days, sir? I don't feel well. I have a fever." He wrinkled his brow, thought for a moment, and took my pulse. "All right, son, come back to see me when you feel better. But don't wait for me to call you." I went back to see him a week later. With the same excuse, I still was not feeling better. He did not seem surprised, and I don't know whether he believed me, yet he most likely was pleased that I had come back on my own, as I had promised. He granted me a further delay. A few days after my visit, the dentist's office was shut down. He had been thrown into prison and was about to be hanged. It appeared that he had been dealing in the prisoner's gold teeth for his own benefit. I felt no pity for him. In fact, I was pleased with what was happening to him. My gold crown was safe. It could be useful to me one day, to buy something, some bread or even time to live. At that moment in time, all that mattered to me was my daily bowl of soup, my crust of stale bread. The bread, the soup, those were my entire life. I was nothing but a body, perhaps even less, a famished stomach. The stomach alone was measuring time. In the warehouse, I often worked next to a young French woman. We did not speak. She did not know German, and I did not understand French. I thought she looked Jewish, though she passed for Aryan. She was a forced labor inmate. One day, when Idyak was venting his fury, I happened to cross his path. He threw himself on me like a wild beast, beating me in the chest, on my head, throwing me to the ground and picking me up again, crushing me with ever more violent blows until I was covered in blood. As I bit my lips in order not to howl with pain, he must have mistaken my silence for defiance, and so he continued to hit me harder and harder. Abruptly he calmed down and sent me back to work as if nothing had happened, as if we had taken part in a game in which both roles were of equal importance. I dragged myself to my corner. I was aching all over. I felt a cool hand wiping the blood from my forehead. It was the French girl. She was smiling her mournful smile as she slipped me a crust of bread. She looked straight into my eyes. I knew she wanted to talk to me, but that she was paralyzed with fear. She remained like that for some time, and then her face lit up and she said, in almost perfect German, "Bite your lips, little brother. Don't cry. Keep your anger, your hate, for another day, for later. The day will come, but not now. Wait. Clench your teeth and wait." Many years later, in Paris, I sat in the metro, reading my newspaper. Across the aisle, a beautiful woman with dark hair and dreamy eyes. I had seen those eyes before. "Madame, don't you recognize me?" "I don't know you, sir." "In 1944 you were in Poland, in Buna, weren't you?" "Yes, but you worked in a depot, a warehouse for electrical parts." "Yes," she said, looking troubled, and then, after a moment of silence, "wait, I do remember." "Hidek the Capo, the young Jewish boy, your sweet words." We left the metro together and sat down at a café terrace. We spent the whole evening reminiscing. Before parting, I said, "May I ask one more question?" "I know what it is. Am I Jewish?" "Yes, I am. From an observant family. During the occupation, I had false papers and passed as Aryan, and that was how I was assigned to a forced labor unit. When they deported me to Germany, I eluded being sent to a concentration camp. At the depot, nobody knew that I spoke German. It would have aroused suspicion. It was imprudent of me to say those few words to you, but I knew that you would not betray me." Another time we were loading diesel motors onto freight cars under the supervision of some German soldiers. Hidek was on edge. He had trouble restraining himself. Suddenly, he exploded. The victim, this time, was my father. "You old loafer," he started yelling. "Is this what you call working?" And he began beating him with an iron bar. At first, my father simply doubled over under the blows, but then he seemed to break in two, like an old tree struck by lightning. I had watched it all happening without moving. I kept silent. In fact, I thought of stealing away in order not to suffer the blows. What's more, if I felt anger at that moment, it was not directed at the capo, but at my father. Why couldn't he have avoided Idek's wrath? That was what life in a concentration camp had made of me. Feinek, the foreman, one day noticed the gold crown in my mouth. "Let me have your crown, kid." I answered that I could not, because without that crown, I could no longer eat. "For what they give you to eat, kid?" I found another answer. My crown had been listed in the register during the medical checkup. This could mean trouble for us both. "If you don't give me your crown, it'll cost you much more." All of a sudden, this pleasant and intelligent young man had changed. His eyes were shining with greed. I told him that I needed to get my father's advice. "Go ahead, kid, ask. But I want the answer by tomorrow." When I mentioned it to my father, he hesitated. After a long silence, he said, "No, my son, we cannot do this. He will seek revenge." "He won't dare, my son." Unfortunately, Feinek knew how to handle this. He knew my weak spot. My father had never served in the military and could not march in step. But here, whenever we moved from one place to another, it was in step. That presented Feinek with the opportunity to torment him and, on a daily basis, to thrash him savagely. Left, right, he punched him. Left, right, he slapped him. I decided to give my father lessons in marching in step, in keeping time. We began practicing in front of our block. I would command left, right, and my father would try. The inmates made fun of us. "Look at the little officer teaching the old man to march. Hey, little general, how many rations of bread does the old man give you for this?" But my father did not make sufficient progress, and the blows continued to rain on him. "So you still don't know how to march in step, you old good-for-nothing?" This went on for 2 weeks. It was untenable. We had to give in. That day, Feinek burst into savage laughter. "I knew it. I knew that I would win, kid. Better late than never, and because you made me wait, it'll also cost you a ration of bread, a ration of bread for one of my pals, a famous dentist from Warsaw, to pay him for pulling at your crown." "What? My ration of bread so that you can have my crown?" Feinek smiled. "What would you like, that I break your teeth by smashing your face?" That evening, in the latrines, the dentist from Warsaw pulled my crown with the help of a rusty spoon. Feinek became pleasant again. From time to time, he even gave me extra soup. But it didn't last long. 2 weeks later, all the Poles were transferred to another camp. I lost my crown for nothing. A few days before the Poles left, I had a novel experience. It was on a Sunday morning. Our commando was not required to work that day. Only Edek would not hear of staying in the camp. We had to go to the depot. This sudden enthusiasm for work astonished us. At the depot, Edek entrusted us to Feinek, saying, "Do what you like, but do something, or else you'll hear from me." And he disappeared. We didn't know what to do. Tired of huddling on the ground, we each took turns strolling through the warehouse in the hope of finding something, a piece of bread, perhaps, that a civilian might have forgotten there. When I reached the back of the building, I heard sounds coming from a small adjoining room. I moved closer and had a glimpse of Edek and a young Polish girl, half-naked, on a straw mat. Now I understood why Edek refused to leave us in the camp. He moved 100 prisoners so that he could copulate with this girl. It struck me as terribly funny, and I burst out laughing. Edek jumped, turned, and saw me while the girl tried to cover her breasts. I wanted to run away, but my feet were nailed to the floor. Edek grabbed me by the throat. Hissing at me, he threatened, "Just you wait, kid. You will see what it costs to leave your work. You'll pay for this later. And now go back to your place." A half hour before the usual time to stop work, the capo assembled the entire commando. Roll call. Nobody understood what was going on. A roll call at this hour? Here? Only I knew. The capo made a short speech. "An ordinary inmate does not have the right to mix into other people's affairs. One of you does not seem to have understood this point. I shall therefore try to make him understand clearly, once and for all." I felt the sweat running down my back. A7713. I stepped forward. "A crate," he ordered. They brought a crate. "Lie down on it, on your belly." I obeyed. I no longer felt anything except the lashes of the whip. "One, two," he was counting. He took his time between lashes. Only the first really hurt. I heard him count. 10, 11. His voice was calm and reached me as through a thick wall. 23. Two more, I thought, half unconscious. The copper was waiting. 24. 25. It was over. I had not realized it, but I had fainted. I came to when they doused me with cold water. I was still lying on the crate. In a blur, I could see the wet ground next to me. Then I heard someone yell. It had to be the capo. I began to distinguish what he was shouting. "Stand up!" I must have made some movement to get up, but I felt myself fall back on the crate. How I wanted to get up. "Stand up!" He was yelling even more loudly. If only I could answer him. If only I could tell him that I could not move. But my mouth would not open. At Edek's command, two inmates lifted me and led me to him. "Look me in the eye." I looked at him without seeing him. I was thinking of my father. He would be suffering more than I. "Listen to me, you son of a swine," said Edek coldly. "So much for your curiosity. You shall receive 5 times more if you dare tell anyone what you saw. Understood?" I nodded. Once, 10 times, endlessly. As if my head had decided to say yes for all eternity. One Sunday, as half of our group, including my father, was at work, the others, including me, took the opportunity to stay and rest. At around 10 o'clock, the sirens started to go off. Alert! The Blockälteste gathered us inside the blocks while the SS took refuge in the shelters. As it was relatively easy to escape during an alert, the guards left the watchtowers and the electric current in the barbed wire was cut, the standing order to the SS was to shoot anyone found outside his block. In no time the camp had the look of an abandoned ship. No living soul in the alleys. Next to the kitchen, 2 cauldrons of hot steaming soup had been left untended. 2 cauldrons of soup. Smack in the middle of the road, 2 cauldrons of soup with no one to guard them. A royal feast going to waste. Supreme temptation. Hundreds of eyes were looking at them, shining with desire. 2 lambs with hundreds of wolves lying in wait for them. 2 lambs without a shepherd, free for the taking. But who would dare? Fear was greater than hunger. Suddenly we saw the door of Block 37 open slightly. A man appeared, crawling, snake-like, in the direction of the cauldrons. Hundreds of eyes were watching his every move. Hundreds of men were crawling with him, scraping their bodies with his on the stones. All hearts trembled, but mostly with envy. He was the one who had dared. He reached the 1st cauldron. Hearts were pounding harder. He had succeeded. Jealousy devoured us, consumed us. We never thought to admire him. Poor hero committing suicide for a ration or 2 or more of soup. In our minds, he was already dead. Lying on the ground near the cauldron, he was trying to lift himself to the cauldron's rim. Either out of weakness or out of fear, he remained there, undoubtedly to muster his strength. At last, he succeeded in pulling himself up to the rim. For a second, he seemed to be looking at himself in the soup, looking for his ghostly reflection there. Then, for no apparent reason, he let out a terrible scream, a death rattle such as I had never heard before, and, with open mouth, thrust his head toward the still steaming liquid. We jumped at the sound of the shot. Falling to the ground, his face stained by the soup, the man writhed a few seconds at the base of the cauldron, and then he was still. That was when we began to hear the planes. Almost at the same moment, the barrack began to shake. "They're bombing the Buna factory," someone shouted. I anxiously thought of my father who was at work, but I was glad, nevertheless, to watch that factory go up in flames. What revenge! While we had heard some talk of German military defeats on the various fronts, we were not sure if they were credible, but today, this was real. We were not afraid, and yet, if a bomb had fallen on the blocks, it would have claimed hundreds of inmates' lives. But we no longer feared death. In any event, not this particular death. Every bomb that hit filled us with joy, gave us renewed confidence. The raid lasted more than 1 hour. If only it could have gone on for 10 times 10 hours. Then, once more, there was silence. The last sound of the American plane dissipated in the wind, and there we were in our cemetery. On the horizon we saw a long trail of black smoke. The sirens began to wail again, the end of the alert. Everyone came out of the blocks. We breathed in air filled with fire and smoke, and our eyes shone with hope. A bomb had landed in the middle of the camp, near the Appelplatz, the assembly point, but had not exploded. We had to dispose of it outside the camp. The head of the camp, the Lagerälteste, accompanied by his aide and by the chief capo, were on an inspection tour of the camp. The raid had left traces of great fear on his face. In the very center of the camp lay the body of the man with soup stains on his face, the only victim. The cauldrons were carried back to the kitchen. The SS were back at their posts in the watchtowers, behind their machine guns. Intermission was over. An hour later we saw the commandos returning, in step as always. Happily, I caught sight of my father. "Several buildings were flattened," he said, "but the depot was not touched." In the afternoon, we cheerfully went to clear the ruins. 1 week later, as we returned from work, there, in the middle of the camp, in the Appelplatz, stood a black gallows. We learned that soup would be distributed only after roll call, which lasted longer than usual. The orders were given more harshly than on other days, and there were strange vibrations in the air. "Caps off!" the Lagerälteste suddenly shouted. 10,000 caps came off at once. "Cover your heads!" 10,000 caps were back on our heads at lightning speed. The camp gate opened. An SS unit appeared and encircled us, one SS every 3 paces. The machine guns on the watchtowers were pointed toward the Appelplatz. "They're expecting trouble," whispered Juliak. 2 SS were headed toward the solitary confinement cell. They came back, the condemned man between them. He was a young boy from Warsaw, an inmate with 3 years in concentration camps behind him. He was tall and strong, a giant compared to me. His back was to the gallows, his face turned toward his judge, the head of the camp. He was pale, but seemed more solemn than frightened. His manacled hands did not tremble. His eyes were coolly assessing the hundreds of SS guards, the thousands of prisoners surrounding him. The Lagerälteste began to read the verdict, emphasizing every word. "In the name of Reichsfuhrer Himmler, prisoner number, stole during the air raid, according to the law, prisoner number is condemned to death. Let this be a warning and an example to all prisoners." Nobody moved. I heard the pounding of my heart. The thousands of people who died daily in Auschwitz and Birkenau, in the crematoria, no longer troubled me. But this boy, leaning against his gallows, upset me deeply. "This ceremony, will it be over soon? I'm hungry," whispered Juliak. At a sign of the Lagerälteste, the Lagerkapo stepped up to the condemned youth. He was assisted by 2 prisoners. In exchange for 2 bowls of soup. The capo wanted to blindfold the youth, but he refused. After what seemed like a long moment, the hangman put the rope around his neck. He was about to signal his aides to pull the chair from under the young man's feet, when the latter shouted in a strong and calm voice, "Long live liberty! My curse on Germany! My curse! My—" The executioner had completed his work. Like a sword, the order cut through the air. "Caps off!" 10,000 prisoners paid their respects. "Cover your heads!" Then the entire camp, block after block, filed past the hanged boy and stared at his extinguished eyes, the tongue hanging from his gaping mouth. The capos forced everyone to look at him squarely in the face. Afterward, we were given permission to go back to our block and have our meal. I remembered that on that evening, the soup tasted better than ever. I watched other hangings. I never saw a single victim weep. These withered bodies had long forgotten the bitter taste of tears. Except once. The Oberkapo of the 52nd Cable Commando was a Dutchman, a giant of a man well over 6 feet. He had some 700 prisoners under his command, and they all loved him like a brother. Nobody had ever endured a blow or even an insult from him. In his service was a young boy, a pipel, as they were called. This one had a delicate and beautiful face, an incredible sight in this camp. In Buna, the pipel were hated. They often displayed greater cruelty than their elders. I once saw one of them, a boy of 13, beat his father for not making his bed properly. As the old man quietly wept, the boy was yelling, "If you don't stop crying instantly, I will no longer bring you bread, understood?" But the Dutchman's little servant was beloved by all. His was the face of an angel in distress. One day the power failed at the central electric plant in Buna. The Gestapo, summoned to inspect the damage, concluded that it was sabotage. They found a trail. It led to the block of the Dutch Oberkapo. And after a search, they found a significant quantity of weapons. The Oberkapo was arrested on the spot. He was tortured for weeks on end in vain. He gave no names. He was transferred to Auschwitz and never heard from again. But his young people remained behind, in solitary confinement. He too was tortured, but he too remained silent. The SS then condemned him to death, him and two other inmates who had been found to possess arms. One day, as we returned from work, we saw three gallows, three black ravens, erected on the Upper Platz. Roll call. The SS surrounding us, machine guns aimed at us, the usual ritual. Three prisoners in chains, and among them, the little pipel, the sad-eyed angel. The SS seemed more preoccupied, more worried than usual. To hang a child in front of thousands of onlookers was not a small matter. The head of the camp read the verdict. All eyes were on the child. He was pale, almost calm, but he was biting his lips as he stood in the shadow of the gallows. This time, the Lagerkapo refused to act as executioner. Three SS took his place. The three condemned prisoners together stepped onto the chairs. In unison, the nooses were placed around their necks. "Long live liberty!" shouted the two men. But the boy was silent. "Where is merciful God? Where is he?" someone behind me was asking. At the signal, the three chairs were tipped over. Total silence in the camp. On the horizon, the sun was setting. "Caps off!" screamed the Lageralteste. His voice quivered. As for the rest of us, we were weeping. "Cover your heads!" Then came the march past the victims. The two men were no longer alive. Their tongues were hanging out, swollen and bluish. But the third rope was still moving. The child, too light, was still breathing. And so he remained for more than half an hour, lingering between life and death, writhing before our eyes. And we were forced to look at him at close range. He was still alive when I passed him. His tongue was still red, his eyes not yet extinguished. Behind me I heard the same man asking, "For God's sake, where is God?" And from within me I heard a voice answer, "Where he is, this is where, hanging here from this gallows." That night, the soup tasted of corpses. The summer was coming to an end. The Jewish year was almost over. On the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the last day of that cursed year, the entire camp was agitated, and every one of us felt the tension. After all, this was a day unlike all others, the last day of the year. The word last had an odd ring to it. What if it really were the last day? The evening meal was distributed, an especially thick soup, but nobody touched it. We wanted to wait until after prayer. On the Upper Platz, surrounded by electrified barbed wire, thousands of Jews, anguish on their faces, gathered in silence. Night was falling rapidly, and more prisoners kept coming from every block, suddenly able to overcome time and space, to will both into submission. "What are you, my God?" I thought angrily. "How do you compare to this stricken mass gathered to affirm to you their faith, their anger, their defiance? What does your grandeur mean, Master of the Universe, in the face of all this cowardice, this decay, and this misery? Why do you go on troubling these poor people's wounded minds, their ailing bodies?" Some 10,000 men had come to participate in a solemn service, including the Blockälteste, the Kapos, all bureaucrats in the service of death. "Blessed be the Almighty." The voice of the officiating inmate had just become audible. At first I thought it was the wind. "Blessed be God's name." Thousands of lips repeated the benediction, bent over like trees in a storm. "Blessed be God's name?" Why? But why would I bless him? Every fiber in me rebelled. Because he caused thousands of children to burn in his mass graves? Because he kept 6 crematoria working day and night, including Sabbath and the holy days? Because in his great night he had created Auschwitz, Birkenau, Buna, and so many other factories of death? How could I say to him, "Blessed be thou, Almighty, Master of the Universe, who chose us among all nations to be tortured day and night, to watch as our fathers, our mothers, our brothers end up in the furnaces? Praised be thy holy name, for having chosen us to be slaughtered on thine altar." I listened as the inmate's voice rose. It was powerful, yet broken, amid the weeping, the sobbing, the sighing of the entire congregation. "All the earth and universe are God's." He kept pausing, as though he lacked the strength to uncover the meaning beneath the text. The melody was stifled in his throat. And I, the former mystic, was thinking, yes, man is stronger, greater than God. When Adam and Eve deceived you, you chased them from paradise. When you were displeased by Noah's generation, you brought down the flood. When Sodom lost your favor, you caused the heavens to rain down fire and damnation. But look at these men whom you have betrayed, allowing them to be tortured, slaughtered, gassed, and burned. What do? They pray before you. They praise your name. All of creation bears witness to the greatness of God. In days gone by, Rosh Hashanah had dominated my life. I knew that my sins grieved the Almighty, and so I pleaded for forgiveness. In those days I fully believed that the salvation of the world depended on every one of my deeds, on every one of my prayers. But now I no longer pleaded for anything. I was no longer able to lament. On the contrary, I felt very strong. I was the accuser, God the accused. My eyes had opened, and I was alone, terribly alone, in a world without God, without man.